This is Gem Archer, and you're listening to the Stage Left podcast.
Welcome to our new episode with Jess Greenfield. Now, we touched on topics we weren't expecting to on this episode, and some of it might be triggering for listeners. Jess discusses challenges with her own mental health, including postnatal depression, the treatment she received that helped, and also what she feels should change in the music industry. Now, as regular listeners will know, that's a topic we explore a lot of on this podcast. What should change in the music industry? And Jess chose to answer that question by sharing some troubling experiences where she felt groomed by individuals in the industry when she was about 18. And it's a topic we explore both on the interview but also offline after. The topic raised an issue for me about some of the visibility of the support available, which there is a lot of actually, for people who are impacted by similar. So I've listed a number of excellent resources in the description of this episode that might be of use to yourselves as listeners. I have to say, out of over 115 episodes of the Stage Left podcast that I've produced, I don't think one's made me think more about the content and the editing process, which Jess collaborated with me on, and the ongoing support for the guest as well. And thankfully, as you'll hear, Jess and her family have been good friends of ours and my partners for a number of years. I think that allowed the interview to go to places that otherwise might not have, and it also allows us to reach out to check in on Jess going forward, which we'll continue to do. The music industry either fuels ego or fuels depression was a key quote from Jess through this listen. And as regular listeners know, I'm lucky enough to be actually one of only two mental health first aid instructors in the UK qualified to support people in a fully accessible way. So I did feel reasonably equipped and confident to explore this topic in the conversation, and also how to best follow up afterwards. It's important we talk about these things and not bottle them up. So I do offer support both in one-to-one and group settings if you want to reach out. My email is chris@thestageleftpodcast.com if you do want to get in touch, or also just to give us feedback on actually what's quite a tricky episode to host and to edit. Thanks for your continued support. Let's hear what needs to change in the music industry with Jess Greenfield. Okay, welcome to the Stage Left podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. This podcast exists to provide free educational content for young musicians entering an increasingly complex industry by telling the stories of some of the unsung heroes behind the success. So go to thestageleftpodcast.com for all episodes featuring musicians who discuss in detail the writing, recording and performing processes with the likes of Elvis Presley, David Bowie, Michael Jackson, The Beatles, Fleetwood Mac, Nick Cave, Morrissey, Alanis Morissette, The Damned, The 1975, The Stone Roses, Jeff Lynne and Kraft. Work. Today marks the return of Jess Greenfield of Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds, who, having appeared pre-COVID discussing her career today, is appearing to discuss what works and what we feel needs changing in the music industry to allow young parents to tour more easily and still take those life-changing opportunities. In addition to this, we'll be discussing the harmonies on Stand By Me and Going Nowhere, that enormous Glastonbury show Prima McCartney headlining, being nominated for a Production Music Award as a songwriter, and recording vocals on the likes of Dead to the World from Noel's most recent album, Council Sky. So it's a pleasure to say that our guest today on the Stage Left podcast is none other than Jess from Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds. Thanks for joining us today, Jess. How's it going?
Thank you for having me again, Chris. It's all going really well. It's a pleasure to be back on your wonderful podcast chatting to you.
And since Jess last appeared, Jess and Gavin as the Condors played our Stage Left Night Supper Club. They headlined our live night at the Groucho. You provided support to my partner and I via Zoom calls, talking us through upcoming water births. My daughter was Jess's first customer for the side hustle cradle and rock baby massage classes that you did during lockdown, which we're going to come to. We both celebrated milestone birthdays together, and it's in these conversations that a complete blind spot to me appeared that we'd never discussed on the show, which is how unbelievably difficult being a mum must be at the same time as a musician who embarks on global tours, right? It's never been on my radar before, and now it's something I really want to shine a light on. So touring as a mum for the last few years, how on earth have you made that work?
That's a really good question, and it was something that I was kind of anxious about from the minute I got pregnant, to be honest, and something I probably put off getting pregnant because of. So how have I done it? I mean, I've got an incredibly supportive husband who, if it wasn't for him, I don't think I would have been able to. I think I would have not seen my daughter enough. And we've got supportive parents And actually, I think just the supportiveness of Noel's tour manager and the band have meant that, you know, they've made her feel welcome. So that has been helpful as well. And also because of COVID, she didn't really, I didn't really start touring properly until she was, how old was she? Maybe 18 months, but that was a small tour around Glastonbury time. And then the biggest chunks of the touring have been sort of since she's been two. So it's not like I'm traveling around with a tiny baby. So yeah, it's definitely been a challenge.
Also just like the obviously logistics and stuff like that, like obviously Gav's been amazing, that kind of thing. What about the kind of feeling of separation from her? I mean, I remember being away from my daughter for one night when she was young, and she's still only 2.5 now, and she was in Lithuania and I was in England for like one night, and I fell into this terrible stupor of like a mood, and I drank way more than I should have because I was so like miserable being kind of separated. But you're sometimes you're like the oceans away, nine nights away. Like,
yeah.
How have you helped yourself in that time to kind of stay sane?
I think partly because of the fact that I am at home a lot when I'm not touring. It's kind of like I'm all in. So when I'm away, it's the time where I can sort of find myself again. And that the tour that we did recently in America was the first time in a long time that I'd started, that I'd remembered sort of who I was pre my daughter.
Yeah.
So I was able to go back to the sort of self-care things that I would do before, like meditation or yoga or just going to the gym or whatever, being able to just have a laugh with mates. And that was really therapeutic. And that helped with the longing to see her. And
did it feel different when you reconnected after nine nights?
Yeah, it did. I was like aching to see her.
Mm.
And they'd flown to Florida, and then they were in the room, and then they were hiding. So when I came in, and she was just like, "Mommy, Mommy." She's so little still, so she was just like, just beside herself. It was just, oh, it was so beautiful, but I hated being away from her. And that, for me, is still too long. You know, it's not ideal for me.
And, you know, for listeners to, the, you know, most of the people listening to this are like either fans of the artists that we have on or like musicians themselves. And I think the point of this is to really show what, you know, we see you on stage for like a couple of hours and it's like you're living the dream, et cetera, et cetera. And then you just see kind of some of the challenges you have behind the scene.
Mm.
Actually, at your birthday, I was speaking to someone, I'm not going to name them, but who is a musician who she's had got an amazing career at the moment, doing some amazing stuff. And she was saying, look, I'm in this situation exactly, like, do I have a child? Do I not have a child?
Mm.
Because if I do it now, I'm going to lose all of these opportunities. It's almost going to be the end of my career because those opportunities will go. And you kind of touched upon, like, you delayed it for that reason, having a child for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
Like, talk us through how you make that decision and how you weigh that up. And you talked about how, like you said, Noel's tour manager and members of the band have been supportive. For musicians listening to this who might be touring in future with women who've had kids, like, what are the specific things that they did?
Just being welcoming with her being there, and allowing them to stay in the hotels, and, you know, because it must have been a shift for them as well. There hadn't been women in the band before, let alone women with small kids. And actually the Roxys, two of them have got kids.
Right.
And, you know, I suppose as everyone has got older and they've all got kids too, it feels like it has just felt more inclusive. And, you know, and my daughter's, luckily she's quite sociable and she's, you know, she's a funny little thing. And so I think she's kind of charmed everybody, which has been really sweet. But yeah, just in terms of hotels and just not shutting me down, you know. And I think, and maybe it's the nature of the sort of genre of, you know, and Noel's been around for years, but if it was a young pop act, I can imagine he would get shut down. And I think that is probably something that really needs to be addressed, is how, you know, if you wanted to have a child at 25, I think it's a really tricky one, because so many young artists are not looking for people that are going to be carrying a baby around. I do know that Harry Styles has got, has he got his drummer? Someone told me that his drummer had had a baby and then he'd sorted out a nanny for them, which I thought was amazing.
Wow.
And you hear about, and Hans Zimmer, I think the bass player in Hans Zimmer's band, had her child or children on tour and he paid for a tutor and stuff. So some people really do make it work. But, you know, without that stuff, you're just constantly worrying about how you're going to make it work. And, I probably delayed it for 10 years. But, you know, the mad thing about it is that now that I've got a child, I've had way better opportunities come to me. And I sort of feel like, obviously, you've got the newborn phase, which is hard. But if you can manage that, I guess I'm a more comfortable version of myself before I had Ava. And I know what I want, and I'm not going to put up with the same shit that I put up with before.
What was the shit you put up with before?
I guess the way people talk to me, or if there was a job that was presented to me, I might have taken it because I thought, oh, you know, I need the extra money, but it might not be suited to me, or maybe it's a real like mission, you know, in terms of like logistics and or working with people I didn't get on with that well, or a style of music I didn't really like that much. But because you think, oh, that might help me get to the next thing. And it's like, I think the music industry is a consistent dangling carrot. And some people get good bites of the carrot. Some people never get to bite the carrot. Some people are constantly eating the carrot. And it's a game. It's a real game. And actually, I was listening to the Kate Nash podcast that you did, and it's so brilliant, and she's so eloquent, and it was really inspiring actually. But when she was saying, when you'd asked her about if you were the president for the day, and she said something about, you know, that it shouldn't just be for the rich people. It shouldn't just, if you're poor, you should be able to have the same opportunities. And I think back in the day you could still have the same opportunities if you came from a council estate. Now there's just, unless you've got a wealthy family or you've got people that are in the industry already, it's incredibly hard. And it's so like, everyone is so sort of like, what's the word? They're all in their little cliques, even the songwriters. It's so hard to get into those cliques, get in there. And yeah, I do think having a baby sort of just, it gives you a bit more strength somehow. Having said that, I know that I'm really fortunate to be doing what I'm doing, you know, in a supportive situation. It's definitely a tricky one to navigate. Sorry, my dog's just coming in. Come on, Suki. Come on.
In regards to the Kate Nash episode that that Jess is citing there, that came from actually an episode that we'd done previously with someone called Bim, who is a singer with Bastille, and she said the words, the music industry is not built for women, and how that women working in the music industry are kind of been retrofixed. They were never in the kind of design phase of like the height of the toilets on tour buses and the certain things that women might need on tour buses, even the time to get ready for shows, etc., etc. Everything's been kind of retrofit in, and we talked about this idea of inclusive design, which is probably the people who sat around designing a tour bus were a bunch of guys, right? And at no point did they actually consult women what they might need in that situation. You've got this thing, and that needs to change. And it was when Kate reached out and said she wanted to appear, and she was supposed to be promoting a film called Coffee Wars, and we didn't even touch upon the topic of Coffee Wars in a film, because as soon as I brought up this topic, it was just kind of right, here we go. So it's worth listening. What do you feel needs to change from your perspective specifically to make the industry more inclusive for women?
I think there's always been a real hierarchy issue around around bands and people at the top, people that are running labels, sort of minions that run around them. And I think still one of the biggest issues, to be honest, is the sexualization of women. But it's a difficult one because in the industry, so much sells on that. So I think it's a very difficult thing because sex makes money, but there's still so much discrimination and harassment and assault that goes on. And it's very hard to monitor that, and it's very hard to speak out about that kind of thing. And I would imagine that most women have had some kind of situation being in the music industry where they've been spoken to inappropriately, touched inappropriately, treated inappropriately. I for one have had multiple situations, and that have kind of in a way shaped me, because I feel like I'm a bit more streetwise to it. But you know what? I also feel like it gives you a thicker skin, but in a way it gives you a skin where you become a bit more numb to it. And I don't know if that's because when situations happened to me, it was years and years ago, before the whole kind of like Me Too, where everyone was a bit more clued up about it. People spoke out about it. Before, you know, no one would say anything. So you'd just sort of laugh and get on with it. And I, you know, stuff still goes on, but people are scared to lose jobs, or, you know, they're scared they won't advance in their career. You know, you think about the whole Harvey Weinstein situation, and I don't know how it can change, but that is something that needs to change, in my opinion, is just for women to be more of an equal level to men in terms of the way that they're treated.
Listen, thank you for, you know, sharing that. And it's kind of been thought for a while that whilst there's been other industries where there'll be revelations, that it's almost like a ticking time bomb where it'll all come out. And we've recently seen stuff in the world of comedy, et cetera, et cetera. I think there probably is quite a lot to come out at some point around that. How long ago was the last incident of that?
10 years ago. Yeah, and these, you know, different, and it's not just like someone in a band, like a musician. You know, it'll be like someone who works in, it could be someone who works in management, someone who works, you know, it's like all across the board. And, you know, and I'm realizing stuff, I'm sort of piecing together how I was treated early on in my career when I was sort of 18, 19. And I was, the other day I realized that, this is going quite deep, by the way, but I think it's because it's you, we can chat. But like when I was 18, I had this guy who was like a manager, and I realized the other day that he was essentially grooming me. He would take me out. He had a really nice car. He'd buy me food. He'd buy me clothes. He'd give me money. And all under the sort of thing of, we'll go over and meet this producer, we'll meet this songwriter, blah, 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 blah. This went on for quite a long time. And then I sort of was realising, well, when I'd sit in his car, he'd try and get me to do stuff. You know, he'd kiss me. And I was 18 and he was probably 50s. And I didn't want to speak up because He's an older man. I thought he was going to help me. I thought no one would believe me if I talked about it. And yeah, and like, and then he introduced me to a songwriter. And that songwriter essentially tried to do the same thing. Over this one night, he basically, I was staying at his house and he came into the room in his underwear and tried it on. And then I thought to myself, my God, is this kind of some kind of like grooming ring? And this only occurred to me like a week ago. And I was like, oh my God, that's exactly what it was. And I just sort of went along with it.
And some of those behaviours that you on the receiving end of are almost, dare I say, like textbook for some of the behaviours you've seen other people in other industries use to promise furthering people's career and stuff like that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And especially the, you know, the buying the clothes and sort of like making, I'll make you into a pop star and I'll pay for pictures. And, you know, they weren't like graphic pictures or anything like that, but you sort of, you think, well, this is all leading up to something. And, you know, and it didn't, nothing happened.
Do you feel those people are still in the industry now and making a living out of the industry?
Yes, but, well, the songwriter was, he'd written songs that were big years and years and years ago, so he'll continue to make money. The other guy is, puts on, he puts on gigs and stuff. I don't think he makes that much money out of music.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was just quite a revelation.
Yeah. I mean, it's obviously concerning if you feel they're still in the industry now, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know whether, I don't know whether the manager is still working with artists. I don't think he is. I think he puts on like shows full of like old school artists that are probably in their 50s or 60s. There aren't any like young girls that he's working with. But yeah, I mean, that's not to say that he's not sort of making his way around.
Yeah. I mean, but also we might have, I don't know, social media people or something like that who aren't in their 50s and 60s or whatever. So
you just don't know.
Yeah. So what we're looking at here is like more safeguarding processes, right, within the music industry. That's what needs to be in place. Do you feel there are more safeguarding processes now than there were then? Like if you were a young artist now, do you think that you'd get the same experiences, or do you think the Me Too campaign has made some kind of dent in that?
I think, yeah, it has made a dent, but I think that, you know, if you worked for a big company, I think you were talking to Kate about it, about, you know, there needs to be an HR department. Yeah. There wouldn't be anyone, there's no one you could go to. If you're an artist on your own, there is no one that you could go to and say, this just happened to me. This person just treated me like that. This person just took money. This person just did this, this, this. So what it does is it means that you have to walk yourself through this industry with all of these different kind of like walls up that you've learned to build up to protect yourself, because you have the knowledge of, well, that could happen, that could happen, that could happen. So basically, I think if I think about myself when I was 18 to now, I feel like I've got very particular focus glasses or goggles where I can like filter out people and situations, because I can see, oh, that person, I don't trust that person, that person I heard about through da da da. You know, you sort of, you know, like when you're at school and you you know, you learn the system, you learn how the school works, and then you can start to break the rules. I'm not saying I want to break the rules, but it's like you learn how the industry works and you learn who the people are. And then you know, well, I'll stay clear of that person, or that person's a good person to work with. Or, but when you're young and you're just starting out, you haven't got a clue. You know, it's a very, very hard industry. Having said that, it's a very exciting industry because.
And there's the carrot.
Yeah, you just never know what's going to happen. You never know who you're going to meet. And.
But you shouldn't be having to build those walls. Those walls perhaps should, or they should already be there to protect you. I whistleblowing, safeguarding, just kind of people not being exposed to those types of situations, that you have to experience those to then go, oh, okay, I've built my walls to be able to navigate the industry. Mm. And now I'm kind of, you know, over a certain age, I'm kind of a bit more, I don't know, savvy to the world. It's like these young people coming into the music industry all the time. Those walls need to be there. As I say, like, you know, the music industry is just missing a massive fuck off, like, HR department, basically. You can, like, speak to, you know, about some of this stuff. And if listeners are listening to this and, you know, there may well be kind of charities or organizations or something like that related to music that we might not know of that, you know, we should, you know, signpost people to around some of this stuff, because maybe it is a case there is some support there, but it isn't well known and we can kind of publish
I think there are charities that support people with their mental health, with depression and anxiety. People in I don't know if it's just the music industry or if it's sort of just
There's a number of those. But this, and people might need that support should they be on the receiving end of what you experienced, right?
Yeah.
But how can we get a step ahead of that so that they might not experience some of those things in the first place, so that they don't have to access those resources, right? That's kind of what we're talking about here. Right, we'll have to have a look out for some of that stuff. Thank you for sharing some of that. What else needs to change?
I wish that there was, I don't know if it was like a grant system or some kind of system set up where there is no fear around having children, and there was some kind of like musician's creche that you could put your, or some kind of like childcare system that followed tours for everybody that maybe the government paid for or something. Or there was some kind of like allowance that meant that you could pay for a nanny on tour, you know, because essentially if my husband wasn't flexible in his work and compassionate and understanding about the music industry, because he's also a singer and also aware of the possible effects of me and her not being together a lot on her well-being and stuff, then, you know, I wouldn't see her, and his job would constantly suffer. Or he'd have to go and work, we'd both be working, and she'd be with my mum, who is, you know, she's not particularly young. It's not an easy thing for her to do, constantly looking after a child all day. Or we'd have to put her in nursery every single day, and I'd have to go 7 weeks without seeing her. And I know people do it, and maybe I'm particularly sensitive around distance and the effects of, you know, mother and child not being together. Maybe that's a particularly sensitive topic for me, which is why it's important that I spend time with her. But I just personally just don't think it doesn't feel right to be away from your child for 7 weeks. And I don't think there is enough support for parents to feel 100% confident in taking that on. You know, there's always going to be, how are we going to manage this? How are we going to do that? You know, when I see a tour coming in, it's really exciting. So, so exciting. But I'd be lying if I'd say there wasn't a part of me that gets like a bit of a sicky feeling, because I don't want to leave my child.
That would be an amazing answer. And there are subsidies in you know, nurseries and stuff like that, so why not for nannies, for touring artists? You know, we want to support our artists, right? That's such a good idea. maybe we should set up a campaign or something like that. We should look at doing.
Yeah.
How do you?
And the thing is, as well, is that if the alternative is that artists or bands could say, "Well, I'm not gonna have that musician on tour. I'll get someone who doesn't have a child." So they don't. Then there isn't any of that logistical nightmare of, "Oh, we've got to book that nanny, or we've got to sort that out." So I get it. I get it on both ways, but I've worked very, very hard, as have lots of other touring mums, to get to the position they're in. So why should it be that we feel like it's one or the other? You know?
Yeah.
It shouldn't be that, where you think, oh no, if I have a baby, oh, I'm never going to work again. It shouldn't be like that.
No.
It should be like, I can work as much as I want and it's still going to be all right.
And the thing that's really critical about that, so you mentioned about Gav's work is flexible. For anyone listening to this who works in companies who are a bit kind of anal about the whole kind of like flexible working thing, the more inflexible a company is, or like your work is, the more it cements the gender pay gap. So the more if you can build in as much flexibility. Now, look, there's some jobs, including your own, you're not going to be upset. Oh, can I change my working hours when you're playing this concert? Like, so you're not going to be able to do that. But if there's like some companies or some jobs that you do, the more flexibility built in as a culture, the more it leads to closing the gender pay gap for these exact reasons, because of the ripple effect that happens. Let's talk about you as a songwriter. So you got nominated not too long ago for Music Production Award, and then some of your songs have been appearing in like that trailer for that film with like Diane Keaton and Richard Gere and like William H. Macy and stuff like that. It was absolutely amazing. How do you think parenting has impacted your songwriting? And I'm not saying necessarily you're writing like love songs to Ava or anything like that all the time, but do you think it's made you more prolific, less prolific, more focused, less focused? Like, how has parenting impacted you as a songwriter? Who are you as a songwriter today that you weren't, you know, 3 years ago?
I think being a mother has really, it sounds like a really cheesy thing to say, but it's really sort of opened my heart more to the more extreme emotions, like intense happiness and very, very low lows. And I think also motherhood, parenthood, because you only have so much time for yourself, you have to be so good with time. So let's say, for example, with the Production Music Awards thing. So somebody will give me an album or some tracks and they'll say, can you write a top line to those tracks? And I've only got a week to do it. And I thrive in that environment. Like, I love to have a deadline, and I love it. It focuses my mind. So that, along with, well, my daughter's in nursery. So, okay, I've got this afternoon. Right. Okay. So that I find really helpful. I really think that I have, when I had the postnatal depression, I felt I've never felt anything like it. So when you've gone to that place, it definitely unlocks something in terms of lyrics, but also the hope that it can go from there to everything's all right again. You know, everything is temporary. It's definitely made me a more honest and not dedicated, but more honest, and I'm just much better with my time when it comes to writing.
How long did you have the postnatal depression for?
And a year and a half, I think. Oh. I think, yeah, it came in waves, but yeah. The darkest was the first year, and then it started to ease. Yeah.
How did you look after yourself during that time? Did you get any support during that time?
Well, again, it was like the perfect storm, because she was born in the second lockdown. So there was nothing. Yeah, it was very, very bleak, and there was no, It was weird, actually, because there were no gigs, I didn't have the stress of, oh, how am I going to manage childcare? But because there were no gigs, I didn't feel like I had any identity. I was like, well, what is the music industry anyway? You know, oh, what is it? Maybe it's all pointless. And what is my life? And what's, you know, it was a very, very odd time. It felt like there was no hope on the horizon.
Yeah, because about 1 in 10 women get postnatal depression. It's really common. Do you think that because of the situation with COVID being at the same time, obviously not knowing when music was going to come back and live venues and stuff like that, do you think that exacerbated it, or do you think it would have happened anyway as a result of becoming a new mum?
I think it exacerbated it because I didn't feel like I had the support. I didn't have the luxury of like going to a cafe with friends or like just getting out and about. It was like the same walk. I mean, I'm sure everyone can relate to this, going for like the same walk around the park, or, you know, I could take the dog out, take my daughter out in the pram. But it just felt very, I don't know, like Groundhog Day. I think if there had been like, oh, come on, let's go meet for lunch, or let's go and, I don't know, let's have a baby play date, or let's whatever, just to feel like I had some kind of community or some kind of support there, that I think that definitely would have helped.
Connection.
Yeah, definitely some kind of connection. It felt like I was disconnected in every way, even disconnected from myself, actually. Which is why touring, especially the last tour, really, like, I felt like my old self again, because I connected in so many different ways. I connected to my friends, I connected to myself. I felt more connected to my daughter. I could appreciate the whole situation because I wasn't in it, you know, in the sort of depths of like domestic, you know, washing up, nappies, you know, all that kind of stuff. I could sort of just take a little breather, which I know a lot of mothers don't even have that luxury of doing. You know, it's kind of all or nothing being a mother in the music industry.
Did you feel at the time that you could reach out and share that with people, or is it something you're just sharing now? I ask that because, you know, I'm a mental health first aid engine instructor, right? And you've come to me in the past on behalf of other people close to you who, you know, wanted some support with, to be able to support them. Yeah, this is the first I've heard of this. So it's quite an interesting thing. It's like, how do we avoid someone who's going through that experience, still caring for, you know, they're obviously, you know, you wanted to care for other people in that situation, but knowing how to reach out to get your own support.
I think it's a difficult one because the whole nature of being in the music industry, particularly if you're on stage, is to perform. So if you're feeling really shit at home, but you have to go and do a gig, that gig will boost you. It will make you feel like you're something. You've got friends, you're loved, you're adored, you look good because you've got your makeup on or whatever, or you're wearing your best clothes, whatever. Do the gig, feels amazing. You come home, you're still on a bit of a buzz from it. Next day, you feel terrible. Then you do the same thing, and then you do the same thing. So I think that is actually quite dangerous, because you're constantly like that, and it's a constant distraction. If you could get to the, so if you took gigs out of it for a minute, you just feel rubbish. So you'd have to reach a point where you seek help. But because, does this make sense, by the way?
It does make a lot of sense, yeah.
Yeah. I think, you know, when you're working with people, obviously you can talk to people about what you're going through. But I think it's very hard to really admit what's going on, especially in this day and age with social media and having to keep posting stuff about yourself. Look how great my life is, blah, 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 blah. Look how great everybody else's life is. And I think that is a very dangerous part of being in the music industry, is that it either fuels ego or it fuels depression. and it's all hidden away. And we're all looking at it on our phones, you know, hiding away from it, and or flaunting how amazing our life is when maybe it isn't. And yeah, it's a very hard thing to navigate. But there definitely needs to be more support, like a helpline. I don't know if, you know, there is this charity, but I'm guessing, you know, is it, does it run all the time? Is it a helpline that you can just ring up and say, I'm really struggling? There must
be. There are helplines, and you can get, and we'll put links to this as Music and Minds Matter, but there are helplines out there, but it's sometimes just people don't know or don't feel confident to reach out.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
And it's obviously not clear. I was going to say that it's obviously not that prevalent. Otherwise everybody would know about it and everybody would be speaking to them when they're feeling rubbish. I mean, I wasn't sure what it was called, you know.
Yeah.
It needs to be more in the forefront of people's minds.
Mm. It's interesting you talk about the buzz you get from gigs, and does it even out now? Because I came to see you a few weeks ago, you played in Brighton, and to see kind of pretty much from your vantage point a sea of people sing along, like the first few times you must have done that would just be absolutely mind-blowing. Does it get to the point where sometimes it just feels like another day in the office and you almost take for granted, oh, it's another crowd that's absolutely massive, and therefore the buzz each time becomes a little less and it's not as many peaks? How does that work in regards to the buzz you get?
I would definitely, I mean, if I said that wasn't true, I'd be lying. Definitely there's days where you just sort of go with the motions, which I know sounds awful, because like, what a thing to do and what an amazing thing to do. And actually listening to Kate saying, you know, that if you're making a living in the music industry, if you're able to be in the music industry and work, you are a success.
Yeah.
So I know that what I'm doing is incredible and it's always amazing. But yeah, there are days where it feels a bit sort of like, yeah, going with the motions, especially if you're touring, because it's just consistently, you know, the same kind of process. But, you know, some gigs are really special, and that Brighton gig was particularly, had really something about it. And I would say it's one of my favourite gigs I've ever done.
Really?
It had a real magic to it. There was something about it. I don't know if it was the weather or, I don't know, the sea, like, because we could see the sea on the left-hand side of the stage, and it was just, I don't know, it was weird, but I just found it really amazing.
It was crazy windy, wasn't it? It was like the windiest concert, like, I think Russ said after, it's like the windiest concert he'd ever played or seen. Did it impact you, like, in your performance? It was almost like gale force winds at times.
I mean, I loved it because I felt like I was in, like, the Total Eclipse of the Heart video.
Nice. It doesn't impact how you can hear or you can pitch or anything like
No, because you've got these, you know, you've got your in-ear monitors, yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, even if you feel like you're going through the motions on a gig, let's say one gig's a bit meh, or, you know, you didn't play that well or whatever, you can't shake off the feeling of, well, we just did this gig in front of however many thousand people. Like, that doesn't leave you. But when you're doing the gig, sometimes you might find yourself drifting off into thought. I do sometimes. But yeah, like, and I think with a feeling of buzz, obviously, like, you've got the connection with your mates backstage and you have a drink or whatever. But when you go back to your room and you're on your own and you lie in bed, that's when sometimes you feel its full effect, because maybe you can't sleep that well, or it takes a while to wind down, or you've got things going in your head, or did I sing that right, or did I do that wrong, or, you know. So it's such a roller coaster of emotions doing this job. Every day there's always something new. You've got to be at the top of your game, you've got to be making sure you know the words and looking good and sounding good and showing up. And, you know, if you've got other things going on in your life, if you've got children, it's like spinning plates. And
given the buzz that you talked about getting each time that you do that for those couple of hours, I can imagine not having that during COVID, and not knowing if that's ever going to come back. I can almost imagine a relationship, and this might not be with yourself, but a relationship that musicians have with that is that it feels like a shot in an arm for the ego, and it's like a great buzz. And then if you lose that and it doesn't happen so much, or it stops completely during COVID, it's no wonder that like people would struggle through that, particularly with postnatal depression. I remember on the Groucho nights we did, I've never experienced anything like this because I've never been a musician to that level, but you might know James Walsh from Star Sailor, and I came out, I introduced him. He just finished his set, and then I was like, do you want one more? And this crowd, and I was kind of buzzing up. And just for those 10 seconds where the crowd, and I was in the control of the crowd, kind of going back, do you want more? And I felt in my fingertips as I walked off, and I was like, holy fuck, like that must be what it's like for musicians every time they play to a con. That must be absolutely incredible. And how difficult that must be if that's then taken away. It's like, how do you replace that buzz? It must be almost impossible. Yeah. No wonder with those combination of things, you know, that happened. And I'm glad, going back to the postnatal depression you had, was it just a case of getting back into doing the music that solved that issue? You know, what advice would you give to a young mum who's in your shoes to either shorten the distance between when that began and when that ended in those circumstances, or like, what was it that you do that helped you kind of climb out of that and maybe keep the wolf from the door coming back?
The first thing that really helped was that I decided to go back to therapy.
Great. Right.
And I was lucky that I could afford to see the old therapist that I'd had. I hadn't seen her for years. And that started to shift something, and to reach out. I think the nature of the way I do things, I kind of don't like to fail. I don't like to be seen as weak. So I kind of put on a front that I was fine. And I don't even think my parents realized that I was really struggling until I, in the end, said, I really need your help.
What was the help you needed?
I needed like almost like help on the ground, you know. I needed someone to just hold my baby whilst I have a shower. You know, if Gav was working or he was away or something, whatever, I just needed to be honest, I needed to just feel like myself again. And actually, I think music, the songwriting, so the therapy and the songwriting, when I had a moment to start thinking creatively, that shone a little light in me to get out there again and start to find myself. Just a little glimmer, but it was there. Like, oh yeah, okay, this is what I do. Okay. I am good at this. Oh, there is something else going on, you know.
It's interesting because when I've used the counselling services through the charities we're talking about, one of the counsellors said to me that a very common thing that happens is you get people who were musicians, who are musicians still at heart, and his words were like, you belong on a stage, who become parents, have to pay the bills, don't do so much of the creative stuff, end up calling up this charity looking for support. And ultimately, all he really needs to say to them, as he told me, is go and start playing some gigs again. And then call me back if you think you need me. And often it's a case that we just lose that creative outlet. Like it was Pablo Picasso who said, all children are born artists. The challenge is to remain an artist as we grow older. And like, you can do that in, you know, what you're doing currently, but there's lots of people who don't get that. So, you know, it's probably not a surprise that you kind of could channel it, that lifted a little bit once you did more of the creative stuff, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's the message, right? Talking about kind of big buzzes from shows, can we talk about Glastonbury?
Oh, yeah.
That was amazing.
Yeah, that was that was definitely a huge thing to tick off my bucket list.
So you were due to do it the year before, and it got cancelled, and it was you went on before Paul McCartney. Paul McCartney's behind the Saturday night, and you did the slot just beforehand. I mean, what all my back.
I know, unbelievable, really unbelievable.
What's your memory? Talk us through that day.
So that day. We were staying in Bristol, and my daughter was staying with me. My mum was there, and then my husband came picked up my daughter, so I got to sort of connect with them a little bit. And then we got the tour bus to Glastonbury, and I remember feeling butterflies, and I don't often feel big butterflies on gigs. I think I'm used to doing them, in a very sort of like non-arrogant way. I don't want that to sound like, but I don't get like really nervous that much. But I did feel nervous. I think everyone had a little butterfly thing going on. People always joke because I've always got really good memories of food and catering.
STC, right? Straight to catering.
STC, yeah. But the catering was really delicious. It was really amazing food. So had some food, went for a wander, and then we went back to the dressing room and started getting ready.
Yeah.
And it was just... It's just so, and I remember I had to pump before I went on.
Really?
Yeah. Wow.
It's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think anything compares to walking out on that stage and seeing the amount of people that are there. I got like a little, almost like, you know, if you've been on a ship or like a roller coaster or something and you get off and you feel a bit like, whoa.
Really?
It's a bit like that, a little bit.
Wow.
Like a bloody hell, this is like almost like an unnatural thing for a human being to be in front of that many people and then watching you.
Yeah.
And obviously knowing that it's on telly and stuff. But my God, it was such a buzz. Such a buzz. So amazing. And like, you know, afterwards, like, well, actually, when we got in the sort of the main, it's not really a green room, but like people could mill about and then everyone had their separate dressing rooms. The amount at one point, like the amount of celebrities in this one bit was just like, it was like an episode of Stella Street.
Springsteen was there, wasn't he? You had a photo of Springsteen. Yeah. Nice.
Yeah. Because
he was, of course, he was guesting with McCartney, right? So he was a special.
Oh, that's right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Did you see Macca or was he warming up?
I did meet him. I met him after he came. Oh, was it after he came off or before we went on? I think it was after he came off.
Oh, wow.
And I've got a couple of friends. Actually, I should introduce you to them. Who play horns for him.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So they'd be great to get on the podcast.
Okay, we'll sort that out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, so I hung out with them. That was really, it was just so lovely. The whole day was just...
Did you watch any of McCartney's set or did you stay in that area afterwards? All right, cool.
Yeah, yeah. And then I went and my cousin was there. So I got to see him. And then there was a bar that we were in and they were playing Paul McCartney's set on the telly. So nice. We watched a bit of it there as well. Yeah, it was just such a mad day. And then like,
did you stay in a tent overnight?
No. So that was the other mad thing. We got the bus back and we arrived at like 5 a.m. or 6 a.m. something. And then... Basically, by like 9 o'clock in the morning, I was sitting on my sofa, just like, oh, well, that just happened. And there I was like, just sitting in my front room like it never happened. It was very weird.
And then since then, you've done the tour with Garbage in America, right? So you did North America tour of like amazing. And you've played the Greek, right? You played the
wow,
that's one to tick off the list, right?
Oh, yeah.
What were your, if you were to look back, you know, when you look back at that tour in years and years to come, what do you think are the things that are going to be the fondest memories of that?
I think the fondest memories of that tour was the friendships that everybody made. How wonderful and so warm and accommodating Garbage were, particularly, I mean, Shirley is just like one of the most inspiring, just like fierce, beautiful people. And you don't always know what people are going to be like, that, especially that have been in the industry for a long time. And, you know, she's just so amazing. And then Metric were there as well. And they were lovely. And it was just, it just felt really supportive. And actually, because I was so anxious about how I was going to navigate parenting whilst my daughter was there for like a month on the American tour, the fact that Garbage was so accommodating made me that little bit less anxious. They were just so lovely.
How were they accommodating? So again, if musicians listening to this, what did they specifically do that made it accommodating so that you felt like that as a parent?
Oh, like they allowed her on stage and they were sound checking And like, she'd run around catering and she'd run around their dressing room and want to talk to them all. And, you know, there wasn't any sort of like, oh, yeah, who's this little girl? Like, piss off. There was none of that. It was just so lovely.
Just being
so
human.
Lovely. Just being human. Just being human.
Couple of the shows I want to ask you about. You did Stand By Me as a one-off with Noel for the Peter Blake show, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Tell us about that, because that's a song that he hasn't played for a long time. And actually, he's been quite disparaging about as a song, I think, from the lyrics perspective.
Okay.
So it was a big surprise that he kind of pulled that rabbit out of the hat. And I don't think he's played it since. I think it was just kind of a one-off for that. Tell us about kind of rehearsing that, and you were singing the harmonies on it as well, right?
Yeah, well, when he said he wanted to do it, I mean, I already knew it because it's a classic. I was an Oasis fan, and I mean, what a privilege. What a privilege. And when we did the Peter Blake thing, it was very, very stripped down. So, yeah, it was basically just me doing BVs. And the Peter Blake gig is a gig I'll never forget, actually, because it just felt like a real celebration of just amazing bands and amazing music. And my dad came to watch. And when we were singing those songs in such a stripped back way, my dad was in the crowd. I imagined him, and obviously it was in the Royal Festival Hall, so it's like seated. And I had this image of him in my school assemblies when I was at primary school, and it made me feel really emotional. And particularly we did Live Forever. And, you know, my dad was sitting there and like, you know, he's an older man and, you know, how he used to sit and watch me. And, oh, my God, it's making me emotional thinking about it. But at one point in the dressing room before we went on, Chrissy Hynde came in, and I've been such a huge fan of hers for a long time. I used to love The Pretenders. And then Paul Weller came in. So it was like, they were having the best, funniest chat. And she, you know, a bit like Shirley, they're just so, like, they've been around men in the industry for a long time. They speak their mind. They're amazing songwriters. They're really original. And they're real big inspirations of mine, actually. So, yeah, that they were real highlights of that gig, just being around Chrissy. And she watched the sound check as well. So, like, that was really cool.
Amazing.
Yeah.
The other thing I wanted to quickly speak to you about, because we're running out of time, but I think it summarizes how women are sometimes perceived in the music industry, and how unfair and wrong this is. I remember sending you an image that I found that had just gone online of you sat at an airport on a carousel.
Oh my Noel, God.
Yeah. With Noel playing guitar. I think you're probably like, you know, a flight was delayed, and it was amazing. It's like you're sat there, and it's a great photo, and it's amazing. And then there was the Daily Mail, the Mirror, and one or two others, and I've actually just pulled it up in front of me, which is Noel Gallagher shared a hilarious snap as he performed to two airport travelers on Thursday, but they seem less than impressed. Blah, 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 played on the luggage belt, but the women in the arrivals hall sat on the bench next to him, just looking the other way. Obviously, the context of that is that you're not just a woman in a, you know, airport traveling luggage carousel area. It's you're a member of the band. How did that make you feel when you read those articles? Cause I saw a couple of your posts. It pissed you off, right?
Yeah, it pissed. I think it pissed both Emma and I off. Emma is one of the Roxies.
Of course, yeah.
We just felt, I mean, actually, I was just stunned at how they spun that story, how they came up with that. Like, and why did they need to come up with that? Just for clickbait. I mean, I've never, obviously, like, you look at headlines and you don't even think about what they might have done to make that more appealing. So to be part of that, I was like, my God, that is actually shocking. I just felt like it was a bit cheap. I just thought, like, I felt disrespected. Like, I get it, but I just felt like, you know, we're working really hard and it's tiring, and, you know, to sort of give the information that we were unimpressed or that we're just like not asked, you know, I don't know. It did piss me off. I felt disrespected.
Yeah, you have a right to be pissed off for that.
Yeah.
Going Nowhere, an absolute deep cut classic that Noel's never done before, which you're now singing the famous harmony on. And there's a thing that, you know, there's some classic Oasis songs, including The Master Plan and Going Nowhere. And there's one or two others where Noel would harmonize with himself. And it's this really lovely thing that he's got on record. And because he can't do that live, right, previously, those songs have often not been played. And so the fact that he did Going Nowhere with that actual harmony, which is such a prominent part of the song, it doesn't work without it. It's almost become harmony almost becomes the lead line in some ways. Tell us about the rehearsals for that one. How did you learn that song?
I learned that basically on every dog walk that I did. I just kept listening and kept listening and kept listening, because actually that it's not a very straightforward harmony. The here am I, that bit, it's not an obvious movement. Yeah, I mean, it, you know, I loved it. It reminds me of like Burt Bacharach. It's just like, also what I love about doing it is when we do it live, we have a big screen and behind it's like a big tour of America, and not us touring, because that would be like a montage, that would be shit, but like old places in America, looks like it's been filmed in the 70s or something. And every time we're singing it, playing it, I look up at the screen and it reminds me of what we've done with the tour. And so that's always a nice feeling. But yeah, it's just such a privilege to be asked to do it. You know, it's just unbelievable.
So would Noel sing the harmony to you, or did you just literally learn it off the record?
I just learned it off the record.
Nice. And just go in there and bash it out.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah. And hope that it's right.
Last kind of couple of things I wanted to focus on is, obviously you recorded in the studio, which is something I don't think you'd done previously when you came on the podcast last time. And there's, you know, obviously some great songs on the Council Skies record. I mean, particularly Dead to the World. I mean, you just mentioned Burt Bacharach. I mean, that's Noel like delving deep into his back catalogue in regards to some of the best songs he's ever written.
Absolutely.
Tell us about when you first heard that song, what your role was on that song, how it worked in the studio and how that song came together.
I got sent the album and he said, I'd like you to sing on these ones. And I listened to them. There was another one, Trying to Find a World That's Dead and Gone, that gave me like the same kind of feeling. But when I heard Dead to the World, I just thought, oh my God, that's amazing. And he just wanted me to sing, there's a lot, so tired. And then it's too bad because I'm sleeping, that bit. And just to be like, I mean, when you go into the studio, they're already sounding amazing. So it's not like it's bare bones. They're already sounding like beautiful records. So, yeah, it's just, I mean, he's an absolute pleasure to work with in the studio. He, you know, he just loves music so much. And you can see he's just so happy to be in the studio. And also getting to work with Paul, who's one of my old old friends, Paul Stacey. It's just, it's like a pinch me moment, you know, because you can hear how incredible these songs are. And I've been asked to sing on it. So, yeah, it's amazing.
And did it turn out on record very similar to the version that you were kind of recording to in the studio?
Yeah. They might add, I think they added real strings, because maybe at that point they just had
synths.
Synths. I think so. Don't quote me on that, but I think so.
Nice.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And Paul is up for coming on Stage Left and will be coming on at some point soon, which is exciting. And we might even record it at the studio. He was up for...
Oh, yes.
Yeah, which would be in which would be incredible. Tell us about, just briefly, what he brings to Noel. Or what he brings to the party so that we hear this final brief.
I think that what they both share is a real obsession and passion for great music. And they have a real mutual respect for each other and their musicianship. And I think that Noel trusts Paul's judgment. And I think for Noel, you know, he's been around the industry for so long. And you always get lots of people that want to be your friend or they want to work with you, bloody blah, blah, blah. But Paul is very consistent and his main priority is to get the best sound or to get the best vocal take or to, you know, to find the best mic for, you know, he goes so in depth that he's kind of a one-off and he's such a brilliant musician. So yeah. I think they've got a great friendship and they respect each other so much. And I think to have somebody like Paul in the studio is pretty invaluable because he just cares so much. He cares so much, as does Noel. They both care about it. And also they've a guy called Callum who runs the studio. He does a lot of engineering and he mixed the last album. So the three of them together is an absolutely brilliant combination because they've got a great friendship, a great chemistry, and they just love to create music and create a brilliant sounding record. So Paul's just a brilliant person to have around.
Cool. Well, listen, thank you for being such an amazing guest on the Stage Left podcast.
Oh, thank you for having me, Chris.
It's gone deep and we'll obviously make sure that I feel that there's going to be more to this going forward. I think what you've discussed is something that will be discussed wider in future. I think it's only a matter of time. What's next for you?
I am currently in the process of putting an album out with Gavin and a friend of ours called Holly Gray. And we've done... a new album under a band name of Wonder 45. So it's like retro soul. And we're going to be putting that out or putting singles out, I think, next month.
Oh, great.
From next month. Yeah. So that's kind of, it's nice to do. It's a new sound. It's kind of, well, it's an old sound, but it's a new sound from what we've done before. And nice to have another creative outlet. So that's going to be really exciting. And what else? Writing more production music. I enjoy doing that. And I really want to work on my own album, actually. So I'm just sort of starting to put things into place to get that moving. I've started writing already, but yeah.
It's interesting. One question I was going to ask, which I'll ask quickly now, which you might have just answered, which is if you found out the world was ending tomorrow, what do you think would be your biggest regret musically? You think, shit, I never got around to doing that.
I wish that I'd... When I was about 22, I spent about a year going to different songwriters and producers. This is through a manager, not that manager I was talking about earlier, a different manager. Put me into with all these different producers and writers, and I wish that I had had a stronger sense of who I was musically to be able to have created a very consistent, coherent collection of songs rather than being swayed by what other people thought I was good at. I wish that I had a stronger sense of self in my 20s, but you know, I've got it now. So,
what's stopping you doing it now?
Nothing.
So I asked that because we had a guest on called Hazel Mills about a year ago, who she plays with. She's currently playing Christine McQueen's, but she's been in Cold Rap and doing stuff like that. And I asked her that question, and she said it was not doing her own solo stuff. And when she released her EP recently, she cited that question as the trigger point to actually do it.
Oh, wow.
So this is your chance now to make sure, commit to it. It's like, okay, there's nothing stopping you. You just said it, and it would be a huge regret. Make sure in a year's time that you actually release that solo album, because we'll get you on and we can talk about it then. But listen,
thanks, Chris.
Thanks for your, like, the way that you've shared stuff. Thanks for your transparency. You've been so open as well. We'll make sure there's some kind of resources in some of the posts that we do if people will kind of want to follow up or need any support around some of the topics we covered as well. But listen, Jess, thanks for being, again, such a great guest.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
So that was Jess Greenfield, and thank you to Jess for sharing her vulnerabilities around some of those areas for the sake of shining a light on it. So hopefully more musicians or individuals anywhere in any business doesn't experience the same. Please reach out to us should you want to give us feedback or get in touch. Chris@thestageleftpodcast.com. You can also go on the website, thestageleftpodcast.com, where you'll find all our episodes. If you're fans of Noel Gallagher, you'll find episodes of pretty much every member of his band. The one with Gem Archer was particularly good. It was his first interview in 5 years when he did it, and he shares experiencing a traumatic brain injury, actually, and how that impacted him. And very lucky to see him a couple of times recently and hang out, and what a great guy, and he's on top form, which is fantastic. Other episodes people might be interested in, Bill Ryder Jones, a two-parter we did not too long ago. Kate Nash recently appeared, as mentioned, that Jess talked about, and loads of others, members of Kraftwerk, Guns N' Roses, you name it. So we look forward to you joining us for our next episode, which is with Aaron Baron Cohen. So you might be familiar with that double-barreled surname, which is Satcher's brother. And every project that Satcher Baron Cohen has been involved in, he's had his right-hand man, which is his brother, with him, creating the soundtrack and the music. And it's really interesting to talk about some of the projects and the challenges around that. It's a good, really good hour of in-depth reflection around the music industry, some of the challenges that come with that, what needs to change as well, and also, you know, some actually, like, there's points of it where I was almost like crying with laughter at some of the stories that he kind of shares about him and Satcher as kids kind of entertaining their parents, and how Satcher's career kind of progressed, scenes that you could imagine in films that he's produced since, actually, and he's kind of sharing these stories, which is really nice. So we hope you enjoyed the episode. Do reach out. And as I say, if you're impacted by some of the topics we discussed, make sure you don't bottle up. Make sure you speak to others. So there's some resources and lists of numbers, et cetera, in the description of this episode. Thanks, everyone. We'll see you next time.